Could grinding sand help create better scientists? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The healthcare data that we provided to build these algorithms is equivalent to, I think, 5 Wikipedias.
You know, we're not really activists. You know, I'm a surgeon, and here it is. You know, there's a mistake happening. You point
it
out.
It was not fun because they're injecting all this poison in you.
They actually took my PowerPoint projector and smashed it on the floor.
And it will go to an asteroid,
good evidence that take people with depression have more information, both in their...
It was never in my mind a life or death thing, even when they told me they weren't sure how serious it was.
On today's show, going caffeine-free for a week and discovering your true sluggish self, a day in the life of an FDA inspector, and moving amputated cockroach legs with voice commands. It's going to get a little weird today. But first, let's open a book of secrets. Great name, right? But it's not a Mason manual or about witchcraft. What we're talking about are manuscripts from the Renaissance period that describe art and craft techniques that were common during that time. Students at Columbia University have been recreating secrets from one such book all semester long, trying their hand at anything from making hourglass sand to casting metals. Along the way, they learned about history, art, science, but the real lessons of the book have gone much deeper. Secrets you can only learn from getting your hands on material.
So it looks like we're between 250 and 270 degrees Fahrenheit right now.
A group of students in lab coats is keeping a close watch on a bright red liquid swirling in a pot. They are wearing protective goggles and masks, and the hot plate sits under a big vent. The liquid looks very much like melted plastic. It's not, though. This is the very first recipe in the over 400-year-old French manuscript, and it describes making fake coral.
Il faut premièrement faire les branches de bois.
One must first make the branches from wood or take a fantastical thorn branch, then melt a pound of the best possible clear pine resin and add 1 ounce of finely ground vermilion together with walnut oil.
Take the first branch. Yay, the first branch. I think I just wrecked my hair.
The manuscript the students are using for this experiment looks like something right out of the Da Vinci Code, 170 pages filled with curvy handwriting in faded ink, interspersed with illustrations, sometimes mid-sentence, containing as many mysteries as it does clues. Mystery number one? Who wrote the manuscript?
We don't know.
Joel Klein is a fellow with the Chemical Heritage Foundation and a postdoc on the Making and Knowing Project at Columbia University, which this class is part of.
So that's one of the things we're interested in, is trying to figure out who wrote it, why were they writing it, where were they writing it. We think it was probably written near Toulouse.
The original manuscript is housed in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and as part of this Making and Knowing project, PhD students have been meeting at Columbia every summer to continue to translate it into English. The manuscript contains hundreds of different how-to instructions. Student Caroline Maris has been struggling to recreate a varnish for lutes.
We had two base ingredients, turpentine oil and lavender spike oil, both of which were extremely smelly, and nobody was very happy with us in the lab that day, which we then mixed with ground amber, for us quite an exotic material, which we again ground by hand, and then our pigments were dragon's blood resin, which is red, or an ingredient which is called terra marita in the manuscript, but we found now is just sort of turmeric powder, so that was our yellow.
Maris has been applying the varnishes she created to a slab of spruce wood.
Unfortunately, it wasn't that successful. Some of these, if they were layered up many times, I think would probably be decent yellow colors, but the red unfortunately didn't come out at all, and we'd have to work a lot harder on trying to make sure that we had a strong enough red and enough red powder in the mixture.
At another corner of the lab bench, students Celia Durkin and Sophia Gans are examining a pretty sad-looking bunch of grapes cast from melted sugar. They were supposed to cook the sugar until it formed threads when shaking, but...
We didn't really understand what that meant because, you know, we really had to...
When it was being shaken and where the threads were supposed to show up when it was being shaken. And we saw the threads, but we were like, but this isn't right because it's not when you shake it. It's when you, like, lift it and let it drop. So it was very subjective.
Yeah, exactly.
And this limitation of the written word as a tool for transmitting knowledge is one of the important lessons of the class, says Pamela Smith. She is a historian of science who heads the Making and Knowing project.
You know, think about a cookbook. You can't put every single action into a cookbook. For example, if you were teaching someone how to cook who had no experience of cooking, it would be very hard to describe to them in the detail needed. So that's just a problem of experiential knowledge. It's very hard to put into writing.
The need for learning by doing was one of the main motivations for Smith to start this project. She caught the bug of hands-on work in the workshop of a silversmith, where she tried to learn a specific process of casting metal objects.
I was, for the first time, really, as a historian of science, you know, a historian of the material world and its manipulation, for the first time I was actually engaged with materials instead of books and documents. And that was a just incredible experience. And I thought, this is something that has to be conveyed to my students.
Students are often puzzled by the lack of exact measurements in the instructions. The author uses ratios, one part of this, one part of that, and qualitative descriptions of what things should look like.
It should be thick as mustard or as thin as the starch that women use for laundry. That's one of the qualitative descriptions in the manuscript. So in fact, these denotations of consistency are much, much more useful than measurements of non-standard materials.
In the lab, every student has experienced a series of failures, from pale lute varnish to box molds that caught on fire. And then there was the silver incident. Here's postdoc Joel Klein.
We were so excited to pour silver, and when we finally did, the silver just exploded everywhere because our molds were too wet.
But Pamela Smith says this failure, especially for students who have so far tried to avoid making mistakes like the plague, is a really important part of the experience.
Failure and then continued experimentation is just part of the process of coming to understand. And that's something that I think is really very much occluded and even forgotten in our testing culture.
Smith says this approach of learning through failure is also visible in the pages of the manuscript.
He couldn't stop experimenting, basically. He then, you know, wrote down all kinds of different ways of doing things in the margins.
And it's one of the connections between this manuscript and today's scientific process.
This period in which craftspeople are writing down their processes is also the period in which what we know as modern science today is emerging. And it's emerging from several different sources, but one of the sources really is craft, the craft workshop, craft knowledge, and the power of productivity and the power of collective work in the craft workshop.
The students are writing scientific papers on their experiments, including their failures, and all of their work is being collected to annotate the original manuscript. Eventually, everything will be available online for other scientists and students to peruse. And as one of the participants put it, the manuscript and the project stimulate more and more questions. It inspires students to keep searching for the perfect mold for casting or the most beautiful varnish for a lute. It's The Pulse, and we're going to stick with experiments for a little bit. All ideas start somewhere, and with that in mind, undergraduate engineers at the University of Pennsylvania are starting with cockroaches. Specifically, they are experimenting with different ways to control the insect's legs after they've been amputated. Think voice commands and brain waves. It's the type of technology shaping the next generation of human prostheses, and as Todd Bookman reports, the assignment give students the chance to channel their inner Frankenstein.
It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
I'm getting a weird vibe in here. When this guy hums into a microphone, a severed cockroach leg wiggles, the different notes causing different movements. One workbench over, four juniors crowd around their own pair of legs, wires snaking out of the thighs. A tall student blinks aggressively, while his teammates stare wide-eyed at their creation.
Our project is dealing with EEG and EMG signals, and so I have electrodes connected to my head, and based on different actions that I do, whether I am keeping my eyes closed or open or blinking my eyes, it generates different signals.
Those signals run through a computer, which turns them into a stimulus, which makes the legs move. All this works because even after amputation, the neuromuscular system stays active for another 45 minutes. Professor Shauna Dorsey says the legs' inner workings are also a decent stand-in for the more complex human variety.
We wanted to pick kind of the lowest phylogenetic species possible and still get motor function. And so that's why we selected cockroaches. And then this breed of cockroach is pretty unique in that its body weight is so heavy that even if it does have wings, it doesn't fly, so it helps to kind of relieve some of the anxiety of the students.
Stephanie Mark's team is in need of a new leg. She plucks a cockroach from its cage, then submerges it in a bucket of shaved ice.
If you poke them and they don't move, then we figure they're pretty much anesthetized.
Using tweezers and a scalpel, she takes the limb.
So the cockroach is on his back, and the legs are kind of curled up. So what we do is lift the leg up and then try to snip it off as close to the body as possible. So we try to work as quickly as we can so the cockroach doesn't come out of its little anesthetized state.
Cockroaches have six legs. This one now has five. Once down to four, it's considered too disfigured to live a meaningful life, and so it will get put in a Ziploc bag and moved to the freezer, where its time is short. Compared to getting stepped on or hit with a rolled-up magazine, it seems relatively humane. The class did go over ethical issues involved with animal research studies, says Vahid Hashmand.
So we had a discussion on cockroaches as species, and they don't really feel. So they don't really realize that they're feeling pain. They might just realize something's off, but that's about it. So I'm pretty okay with it, actually.
Vahid's team came up with a system of movement that uses hand claps. Some of today's most cutting-edge human prostheses rely on extending the signals that travel from the brain down into the artificial limb. Vivek Meenam's group is working on something along those lines.
I think we're one of the few groups that are actually trying to integrate actual physiological systems, signals. Like, we have electrodes to the arm and then processing it and then also outputting it on the cockroach. So it's a little bit complex, but on the other hand, it probably won't work quite as beautifully as the other projects.
For beauty alone, I give the award to Brian Tong and his crew.
And we're making Rock'em Sock'em cockroach legs. And basically what happens is if you've ever played Rock'em Sock'em Robots, you got two guys trying to punch each other out, and instead of arms, we have cockroach legs.
They've even made a little boxing ring. Lego men with legs for arms square off like Pacquiao and Mayweather, the appendages throwing jabs when the students manipulate a handheld sensor. It has little to do with real life, but it's funny, and that seems to count.
We stress the fundamentals, and I fear that we stifle creativity.
This is David Meany, chair of bioengineering at Penn.
And it's one of the things that we try to stress, because I think if we are going to educate engineers, we also need to educate creativity in some way, and this helps them with that.
Meany says the plan for next year is a competition, with students voting for their favorites. The next generation of biomedical devices conceived one little leg at a time. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
I know you want to see a video of all that, and guess what? We have it on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up, we ask our lab rat to make a big life change.
It's the middle of the night. It's almost 3 o'clock in the morning. On day 3, I guess, technically. But yeah, this the sleep stuff seems to be kind of rearing its ugly head. You know, you don't have that crutch to lean on.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at ibx.com and rideindigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that some of the most exciting innovations arise from external collaborations. With approximately 850 partnerships around the world, AstraZeneca aims to accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines by teaming with distinguished scientists and academic institutions and like-minded science-led companies that contribute complementary technologies, know-how, and molecules. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our lab rat is back in the studio, Zach Seward. We asked him to change his habits drastically for 1 week. He stopped drinking coffee, quit all caffeine, cold turkey. That's a big deal for anybody working in journalism or pretty much anybody alive. So, Zach, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm through the worst of it.
So you're still caffeine-free right now?
I am caffeine-free. There's not a drop of caffeine in my blood at all this moment.
All right. So what did you learn as you went through this week?
Well, I learned that coffee is a magical elixir, first and foremost. I learned that going completely caffeine-free for a week is doable, but not super enjoyable, at least for me. And one researcher did pretty much call me a junkie, which was cool.
I would wager that caffeine is probably the most used psychoactive drug in the world. Maybe second to alcohol, maybe not.
Who's that?
So that's Michael Grandner. He's a friend of The Pulse and a researcher at Penn who studies sleep. And he's looked into how caffeine affects how people sleep. And he says it's a, quote, huge factor.
Many of us turn to caffeine as a way to maybe replace sleep, where rather than sleeping a little more, we're like, well, we can drink that coffee in the morning. It'll get us going. It'll get us able to do what we need to do during the day.
So I found out this week that I am definitely guilty as charged on that front. I use coffee to mask all sorts of sleep deprivation. I have young kids. I work a lot. I drink maybe 3 or 4 big cups of coffee a day. You know, it's like 1 or 2 at home and then a couple at work. Mike, and I know you know how it is because here at WHYY, there's a really fancy coffee machine. It's just hard to resist.
The latte lounge. Yes.
Yes. So I talked to Grandner on day one of this experiment for not so much a physiological explanation of what I could expect, but more of a behavioral one.
In terms of how you're probably going to feel, you're probably going to feel more sleepy. Usually when you take away a drug, you know, what's going to happen is the opposite of whatever that drug does. So if the caffeine's been keeping you awake, you'll probably find yourself having a little more trouble keeping your eyes open. You might find yourself having a little more trouble having quicker reaction time, for example.
I found most of this stuff to be true, especially that sleep thing. So my producers here asked me to keep an audio diary of this experiment, and I think this clip pretty much sums up my experience.
All right, day 2 recap. It's the middle of the night. It's almost 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, day 2 wasn't too bad. Had some faint headaches here and there. But yeah, just the sleep stuff seems to be kind of rearing its ugly head. I felt kind of tired throughout the course of the day, and you know, you don't have that crutch to lean on.
So you were awake at 3 a.m.? Why?
Yeah, well, I fell asleep putting my daughter to bed and woke up
at 7 p.m.
Yeah, at 7 and like woke up at like midnight in her room, and then I couldn't get back to sleep again.
And then how did you feel the next day given that interrupted sleep cycle?
You know, I felt all right, a little groggy, admittedly. And, you know, that's something that Grandner had told me to expect.
To some degree, this is probably the effects of going away from the caffeine, not necessarily where your normal functioning is. But to some degree, it might also be unmasking, you know, some of the issues that you were sort of covering up with the caffeine.
So is this the real me, this like sleepy, like drowsy, kind of dumber me? Is that the real self that I've been masking all these years?
Fortunately, probably not.
You're too kind.
What did you discover, though, about the
health effects of caffeine. So we know how it makes us feel and when we don't have it, but it has a reputation that it's not good for you.
Yeah, that's the thing that really got me interested in this whole topic in the first place, because it definitely does seem like every few years there's a new verdict on coffee and your health. But there was a pretty big proclamation earlier this year from a board of nutritionists that advises the federal government.
Is coffee safe to drink? How much is safe to drink for the average American? That's the question that we took up.
So that's Tom Brenna, and he's a nutritionist and chemist at Cornell University who sat on the 2015 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. And when they announced their findings earlier this year, headline writers had a field day.
You guys recommended that up to 5 cups of coffee a day is A-OK. That's a lot of coffee. How did you come to that conclusion?
Right. So let's be clear about what we mean by 5 cups of coffee. We're not talking about 5 ventis. We're talking about old-fashioned 8-ounce cups that would deliver up to 400 milligrams a day of caffeine.
5 cups still sounds like a lot.
Yeah, but remember, it's these piddly, like, 8-ounce cups. It's not your standard issue mug, you know?
Nope. I go for 16 ounces.
Of course, of course. So even if you're on the high end of the recommendation, like I am, and reports show that most Americans aren't, they drink like a cup and a half a day on average, Brenna says you shouldn't worry too much about the guidelines.
The data indicate that if anything, it was even a little bit protective, but I don't see any evidence, and none of us saw any evidence, that up to 400 milligrams a day for the average person will be a problem.
So it's not the coffee, it's the lifestyle, perhaps. Is that where that bad reputation maybe came from?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, studies now show that coffee has all sorts of antioxidants and maybe some positive impacts on your health. But it's a really interesting question that I kept falling back to. I mean, researchers at Harvard explain it as coffee and cigarettes being really tightly linked for a very long time. So early studies may have had a hard time differentiating the effects of the coffee versus the smoking. And I think that sort of colored some early research suggesting that coffee was bad for you.
So you've been caffeine-free for an entire week. Are you going to stay that way?
Oh, no way. I'm going back. I'm going back as soon as possible.
All right. It's your lucky day because our managing editor, Joel Patterson, is bringing you a cup of coffee right now.
Oh, yes. Joel, your sweetheart. All right. I'm ready. Here we go.
You ready for your first sip?
I'm ready for this.
Smells good.
So ready. Yeah, it's good. Thanks, Joel.
Zach Seward is our lab rat, but in his other life, he is the editor-in-chief of Technically. It's a network of tech news sites that are all over the East Coast. And he's been bouncing around high on caffeine ever since he did this story for us. His experiment got us wondering if he could have maybe just drank decaf instead. Is that really totally caffeine-free? And who likes that stuff anyway? So we asked a serious coffee connoisseur to brew some for us.
My name is Matt Scottoline, and I'm the director of coffee at Reanimator Coffee in Philadelphia.
Okay, so what is decaffeinated coffee?
Decaffeinated coffee, technically speaking, is coffee that has had just under 98% of its caffeine removed.
How do you get the caffeine out of the coffee bean?
There are two main ways to do it. There's chemical processing and water processing. Chemical processing involves soaking the beans in water and then the addition of a chemical, which binds to the caffeine and makes it easy to extract the caffeine from the solution, which is then reintegrated with the coffee. And then the water processing involves soaking the beans in a water solution that is saturated with all the chemical compounds found in coffee, except for caffeine, which then only extracts the caffeine during that steeping process.
Why do people drink decaf? In your experience, what's the point of decaf?
I think it's all experiential. It's that person who, for one reason or another, either they react badly to caffeine, or maybe they're pregnant or something like that. I don't know. So maybe it's just late in the day and they don't want any more caffeine, but they still want to have a coffee. So I always feel like decaffeinated coffee should taste good because anybody drinking it is drinking it for just the flavor.
So what are we tasting today?
There's two coffees on the table. One is a standard caffeinated Colombian coffee. It's a single origin Colombian called Cauca. And the other is a Mexican water-processed decaf coffee. So I'm not going to tell you which is which until you taste them.
Okay. Do you want to pour? Or yeah. So because so you know which one is which.
I do know which one is which. So let's try this one.
All right.
Ooh.
That's very good. Has quite a bit of acid, right?
A little bit, yeah.
I like it though. So we'll try the other one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hmm.
And they are from different origin countries, so there's going to be different flavors either way.
I can taste that.
Yeah. So they should taste fairly different.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, which one is caffeinated?
Yeah, no idea. Just guessing, I would somehow guess the first one I drank would be decaffeinated, but I really don't even know why I'm saying that.
Well, you're right.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
The blue cup was decaf.
All right. To me, it tasted a little bit more of the acid, but this one had more of the what I think of the coffee kick.
Sure.
So, all right. But they were both very good, and if I didn't know that one of them was decaffeinated, I would have not even ventured a guess.
Yeah, and I think with a lot of the higher quality coffees that are being put out there in the specialty coffee world right now, there's a lot of really great decafs out there that you could drink for pleasure, whether you knew that it was a decaffeinated coffee or not.
What's your ratio in terms of sales, calf versus decaf?
I mean, without having any numbers in front of me, I'd say, 99-1.
Okay.
It's just, I mean, we don't even keep it brewed. Like in our cafes. But if someone wants it, we'll hand pour them one or something like that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Matt Scottoline from Reanimator Coffee talking about decaf with us. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and recovery. And we're going to hear about a very unusual experience today. Unusual because it's told by a 7-year-old, Brian Sadowski, and because Brian had a stroke. It happened as a result of a tangle of abnormal blood vessels that ruptured in his brain. Here's Brian telling his story with his dad, Tony, a WHYY colleague, sitting by his side.
It was one night swimming class, and I was over near the deep end. My arm stopped working. I was trying to get my arm up. I still felt it trying to move, but I couldn't get up. And when we got to the other side of the pool, I got out of the pool and sat on the lifeguard's lap. My mom came over. We talked a little about it, but before I could, say anything, I fell asleep. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't feel anything, hear anything at all. I was pretty lucky. I was with a lot of people. They called an ambulance, and we went over to the hospital that Emmy was born. They said, you should probably go over to CHOP. So we went over to CHOP. Daddy went on the helicopter because Mommy knew he would get lost and Mommy would have two things to worry about, Daddy and me. Then I arrived on the roof of CHOP. I arrived in the ICU, which was the 7th floor. I think after 2 days I woke up. I had an MRI. It's a brain x-ray. And I got a stuffed animal, which his name is Dylan. I wasn't talking. I had, IVs in my arm. They had to give me a nose tube so I could eat. So I wasn't able to eat anything from my mouth. But I did eat a piece of bacon off of Mommy's sandwich, which it felt like. Then there was, a piece of bacon in my nose. I think we stayed there for a week and a half. I had a brain boo-boo my whole life, and we didn't know it because no one has x-ray vision. And I had a stroke. that blood vessel leaking. Therapy started getting movement back, even though the brain boo was still there. And I think the third surgery was to actually get rid of the brain boo. They had to take out staples out of my head. It was very painful. I don't know how many there were because I couldn't see my head. They had to take something else out when I was on the ninth floor. Stitches, which were little strings in my head. I actually didn't have therapy in other rooms yet. I had therapy in my hospital room. It was still kind of hard to walk. I walk like on my tippy toes. Yeah, they helped me get movement back. They told me the leg would come back first because it has bigger muscles than the arm, which would take longer to get back. It was very hard to deal with it all. I went for a lot.
That's 7-year-old Brian Sadowski talking about a stroke he suffered in January. His dad, Tony, was right by his side, and he asked him, "Why did you get sad at the end of telling your story?" And Brian said it was because he missed all the friends he had made at the hospital and all the people who helped him through this experience. He had 2 operations to fix abnormal blood vessels in his brain, and he was in the hospital for a total of 2 months. He actually celebrated his 7th birthday there. And he's still working on regaining full function in his arm and leg and remains in physical therapy. Elizabeth Perez Luna produced this piece. Coming up, when you're an inspector for a big government agency walking in to check out a food factory, nobody's happy to see you.
In all my years, I have yet to have anyone tell me, "Oh, this is a great time for an FDA inspection."
Tales from an FDA inspector, still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that collaboration with other scientists and organizations can help accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Have you ever tried to find out how much a medical procedure is going to cost you before you actually have the procedure done? It's all but impossible and something we've been covering here on The Pulse.
So I called around to a lot of different hospitals to find out how much amniocentesis cost.
How much was the CT scan going to cost?
No one would tell me.
And the two nurses just looked at each other in shock, like, "We don't know."
I ended up getting a bill a month later saying that it was $1,000 more.
It could put me in overdraft or serious financial difficulty.
We're working with a company called Clear Health Costs to create some transparency around the cost of medical procedures. You can enter your medical bills, what you have paid, on our website, whyy.org/pricecheck. And reporter Alana Gordon has been keeping track of our progress for us, and she joins us now for an update. Alana, how are things going?
Good. Things are good.
All right. You sound stressed out.
Well, it's complicated, but we are hearing from lots of people. Lots of listeners are reaching out to us and providing some really great insight into the health system and into prices and costs. We've gotten over 200 entries, everything from mammograms to sleep tests. So that's really great. That can help inform our reporting and what we learn.
And the more entries we get, also the more questions we have. For example, you recently drilled down on the issue of colonoscopies, and there it's just simply not one charge. There are many charges.
There are. There's the facility fee. There's the doctor fee. There's the anesthesia fee. And, you know, we're really interested in people sharing all those fees so that we can line it up and compare one thing to the other, which can be really complicated. During that reporting, super interesting, recently heard from a provider who was looking through the database and saw that a patient had come to their facility. And what this person from Doylestown Hospital emailed and reached out was to say, wow, this is really puzzling that somebody would pay $2,000 for a colonoscopy at our facility. That doesn't seem right.
So what did you find out?
So the patient granted permission for me to talk to the insurer and to the providers to check on all this. And I have to tell you, during this process, Mike, and I kind of felt like I was being spun around, caught a little bit in some absurdist drama that didn't make a lot of sense. So I'm trying to like navigate through and find this thread, and I'm making it through step by step. But just to give you a sense of the fragmentation in this process, to put two and two together, the provider that does the colonoscopy is separate, though affiliated, from the hospital. So their bills, their charges are different to the patient. And I got the two groups together to talk about this by phone. And it turns out that they don't talk about those things with each other. So here's an excerpt from Debbie Welker, who was kind enough to walk me through this. She's with the provider Central Buck Specialist.
In technicality, we're not supposed to know each other's rates. That's a private, corporate, proprietary information. And they even speak about that in the agreements that you sign as participating providers.
So as a provider, under the technical agreements, you're not technically supposed to know what the facility is charging where you're doing the colonoscopy?
Correct. Yes, that's correct.
So the hospital where the procedure is taking place doesn't know how much the specialist who's doing the procedure will charge the patient and vice versa?
Technically, no. You know, we've talked a lot about like restaurant metaphors in some of the stories we've been doing about health costs. And the best way for my own understanding of this to conceptualize it is imagine going to a restaurant to get a meal and you get a bill from the cooking and the food preparers. And then you get another bill from like the actual restaurant space where you ate and the servers. But those two groups don't overlap in terms of what they know of what those charges are.
So it sounds like you have to do some more reporting on this particular issue.
Absolutely. And what's so important and great is having the provider, the insurers, patients weighing in so we can really help reflect what's going on.
And it seems like as a reporter, you can come in there and address some questions that even the other parties can't even talk about amongst themselves.
In a lot of ways, yes. I mean, and that hinges on people sharing these charges and prices of what their experience has been with medical procedures. It's not there right now. So we're hoping to learn some more about it.
And going through this information also really gives us a lot of clues in terms of which questions to ask and what to explore. So I'm asking our listeners again right now, keep those medical bills coming at whyy.org/pricecheck. And if you have any questions at all, just email us. Alana, which procedures are you really interested in right now?
We want to take a stab at imaging procedures right now. Very common. Think about MRIs, X-rays. Another issue that we've been hearing about from listeners is these price estimators. If you have insurance, some of these plans are offering up a service where you can look up an estimate of a price for that colonoscopy before you go out and get it. How's that working out for you? Really curious to know.
All right. Thank you so much, Alana.
Thank you.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We hear about scary news all the time.
We begin tonight with Bluebell Ice Cream halting production on at least 8 of their products after they're linked to 3 deadly Listeria cases.
In Kitchen's peanut butter, 30 people in 19 states were all sickened by salmonella.
The Michigan man believes he was one of 11 people in 4 states sickened by E. coli-tainted ground beef.
Who's out there policing the production of our food and medicine? In Philadelphia, it's Karen Campbell. She leads the investigations branch of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for our region, and she stopped by for our series, So What Do You Do?, where we pair lay people with the professionals who work in health and science. This week, the founder founder of Philly's Public Health Nerd Club, Jennifer Chapman, asked Campbell,
"So what do you do? What does the FDA do?"
So I'm responsible for ensuring that the companies that we regulate, that produce the consumer goods that, you know, go to you and to me and our families, are safe.
Sounds like a huge thing.
Yes. It's said that we regulate about 25 cents of every consumer dollar spent. So medical devices, biologics, cosmetics, dietary supplements, tobacco, turtles, small turtles, raw milk.
What did you mean when you said turtles?
The concern is that they can transmit salmonella. Kids play with turtles, put their hands in their mouth, and they can contract salmonellosis.
Do you drink raw milk?
No. And specifically because raw milk, it's not pasteurized. It can contain pathogenic bacteria that could cause illness.
And you don't eat sandwiches from vending machines?
No. I mean, if you ask any FDA investigator that's been around for a while, you all, you know, you develop your own kind of, phobia about certain things because of what you've seen on inspection. I could tell you stories all day. I was with a senior investigator. I was being trained on how to do inspections. And we went to a place in Philadelphia. It was in an older industrial section of Philadelphia, an old building. And this place made sandwiches that you could buy from a vending machine. The senior investigator told me, "Now, Karen, I want you to go into the ladies' room and check and make sure they have soap, hot water, paper towels, and a sign saying that employees must wash their hands." And he said, "I'm going to do the same thing in the men's room." So we go to our respective restrooms. We check it out. We come back. He says to me, "Well," I said, "there's no sink."
Oh, no.
And then it just went downhill from there. We saw widespread rodent infestation. When the marshal issued the seizure warrant to the president of the company, he lost it. He went ballistic. He was so angry. He was yelling at the marshal. He was yelling at us. It was a very, very uncomfortable situation. And the workers, you could tell they were kind of stunned. I see out of the corner of my eye, a woman approaches me. And I thought, oh, well, instead of yelling at me, which I thought she was going to do, she placed a hand on my arm and she said to me, "You have a very important job to do."
Wow.
Exactly. Wow. I think for me, it was a defining moment and it made me realize that this is a career that I wanted. You know, 31 years later, I'm still here.
So how do you find out about things that need to be investigated?
There's a lot of different ways. For example, a consumer calls, they fed their baby infant formula and the baby was ill. So we will go out, we'll meet with the consumer, we'll try to get, get some information, get the medical records, and, you know, kind of trace back where was the formula manufactured, get some samples to see if there was anything wrong with the formula.
Do some of your cases ever end up in the criminal courts?
Yes. We don't have to show that they intentionally decided to go against the regulation for just, you know, for being perhaps careless or just negligent or perhaps not really understanding what your responsibilities are for not following those regulations, even though there's no intent, you could be criminally prosecuted.
It seems like you guys cover so much.
So we can go as large as a multi-billion global company. So think of drug manufacturers, so places that draw blood and process blood, human food, pet food, animal feeds, veterinary drugs, human and veterinary medical devices, also consumer products such as microwave ovens and televisions. They fall under our jurisdiction as well.
Is there anything that you wish people understood better about your job?
I guess I wish they understood that we can't just shut down people. We don't have these broad enforcement powers. And let me explain that. I mentioned prosecution. We can enjoin companies. We can seize goods. But the decision does not rest with FDA. We have to go to the federal, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the federal courts.
And how long could a process like that take?
Unfortunately, it could take several months.
Mm-hmm. When you call a company or someone that you need to go out and visit, how do people normally react to that?
In all my years, I have yet to have anyone tell me, "Oh, this is a great time for an FDA inspection." but our inspections are generally unannounced. But I think most companies kind of understand that it's kind of, you know, it comes along with the cost of doing business, is that you're going to be inspected by FDA. They want us out of there as soon as possible. So generally, they're very cooperative in getting us the information and the records that we need to see.
Karen Campbell is Investigations Branch Director for the Philadelphia District Office of the Food and Drug Administration, and she spoke with Jennifer Chapman for our series, So What Do You Do? Tanya English produced this piece. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Every year, millions of boys earn badges for activities like learning to camp or hiking through the woods, character-building exercises put on by the Boy Scouts of America. But very few, less than 10%, remain dedicated enough to become Eagle Scouts, the organization's highest level of achievement. Reporter Steve Trader found one 20-year-old King of Prussia man who did this in a very special way with an assist from new technology.
Kevin Rafferty recalls the day that Christian Matkovich completed his Eagle Scout Board of Review last September, the final step in becoming essentially a Navy SEAL of the scouting world.
We had two interviews, and the last one was wild. It was really, this is a big deal. This was the final speech.
As Kevin tells it, inside the room, five men in uniform were seated behind a long wooden table. Christian, with his thick, dark-framed glasses and curly mop of hair, his light brown scout shirt and red handkerchief, is dead center on the other side.
Time is rolling along. I can feel the tension. I can feel the fatigue. It's getting harder for Christian. His body's not cooperating, but you know what? Every question that's thrown at him, he answers.
They asked him questions like why he deserved this prestigious honor. Christian scanned through his vocabulary.
My enthusiasm for life and for scouting is second to none. I am brave and put maximum effort into all my activities. I am also a well-rounded young man.
Yeah, Christian isn't your typical Eagle Scout candidate.
I enjoy taking part in live theater. I also love watching professional sporting events such as football, baseball, and basketball.
He suffers from spastic quadriplegic cerebral palsy, the most severe kind. He is bound to a wheelchair, as most of his body has about the same amount of muscle control as a three-month-old baby. He's completely immobile, fed through a tube, and can't speak on his own, which makes his achievement all the more remarkable. He earned over 21 merit badges, accomplishing feats like boot camp, shooting a gun, and camping on the beach. He served as troop leader for 6 months and carried out a community service project. Sure, there was a string attached to the gun trigger that someone else pulled. His mother pushed his chair through Valley Forge where he camped in the winter. But Bob and Mary Matkovich say that their son earned it.
Don't make assumptions, because that's been done in the past. And until you meet him and see what he's capable of, he persevered. He did this.
And one of the ways he did was through an augmentative communication device. Christian can't speak, so he relies on a digital voice generator to get his ideas across. Attached to the front of his chair is a computer screen which scans through phrases like family or hobbies. Next to Christian's head is a large red button, and when the computer lands on a category he wants, he leans to click it. A new page opens with more specific options. He waits, clicks, until eventually the digital voice pipes up.
My most important resource is my family. My next most important resource is technology. It is very important to me. It helps me to communicate with others.
But that same device that allows him to recite his scout pledge or talk to his troop isn't without issues. Like if he misses a head click, he has to wait for the words to cycle back through, which can be tedious and exhausting.
You know, in many ways, we've increased our capabilities to serve individuals like Christian, but we've also, still face some of the same challenges, and there's a need for ongoing research.
David McNaughton is an education professor at Penn State University and part of a nationwide research consortium on assistive communication devices. He says that in some ways, research depends on the general population. When interest in, say, speech recognition technology explodes, the disabled community directly benefits. As the technology gets cheaper, more options become available.
The ongoing challenge we face for individuals with severe physical disabilities is identifying controllable movements that they can use to make selections with the AAC device.
For instance, eye gaze technology would let Christian voice a word just by looking at it on a screen, but he can't maintain eye contact long enough. brainwave reading technology is, at best, a distant new frontier. Instead, McNaughton and researchers are attempting to harness something more instinctual.
Often for somebody like Christian, his parents, when interacting with him, know that when he looks at a particular location with a particular expression on his face, for example, that there's something that he wants.
What the group is looking into is technology that can act the same way, reading Christian's face to help him get his words out faster. McNaughton hopes to be testing prototypes within 5 years. For now, though, it's safe to say Christian has made the most of what he has. Within a few hours of his board review last September, he'd found out that he'd passed the final test. 2 weeks ago, his elite status became official.
Life Scout, Christian Makovich, we're finally at the point you have been waiting for. It's my privilege and pleasure to pronounce you an Eagle Scout.
For The Pulse, I'm Steve Trader.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto is executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And also, that's where you can get in touch with us. Send us your questions, your feedback, your ideas. We love hearing from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.